Good evening, friends. Welcome back to The Front Porch. My name is Dennis Rogers, and I am joined by Michael Daniels. How's it going, Mike? How was your Monday?
Excellent. Mr. Rogers, everything is going fantastic. I unfortunately did not get to watch a lot of Shogun last week. I watched an episode after last week's podcast because I was excited to watch it. And then the whole week got real busy, and it was filled with other things I was doing. And now I'm really coming to you because I love the show and want to watch it again. And I'm dying because episode a week is not enough for me. Although that's my anti-binging philosophy, still. Maybe I'm building up my own hype type thing. Doing it week to week. How's your week been?
Pretty good. I went back and forth a little bit with that show. Like, I wasn't sure, you know, sometimes you watch some, or at least I do, and I struggled a lot to keep the character straight. I'm sure I've said that. But I think back on it, and I'm like, did I enjoy the earlier episodes? I feel like I did, but I never know when, like, I don't know how to describe this. When something's going to be not necessarily bad, but, like, problematic or whatever. And then later we watch. I had that a little bit more with Fallout, which I've seen all of, and maybe we'll talk about a little bit later. But that I was like, is this good? Like, I think it's kind of good, but are people who really, really got it? Because I've played I played a little bit of, like, five of the games, almost all of them, except for the very first one, Fallout 1. And I played a lot of New Vegas and 4, but I don't really remember the lore. And New Vegas was over a decade ago. And so I'm like, I don't know, are they screwing up the lore? And I'm sure there's somebody out there that doesn't like it. And there are, I saw somebody on TikTok with screenshots of comments people left about, what did they say? Like, mixed race marriages. I'm like, people in 2024 are complaining about mixed race marriages in a fantasy, like, I don't know. Like, it's not, like, it wasn't really the 50s. Like, people get that, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's not the real 50s we knew. They had robots and stuff.
Well, I'm on episode 5 of 9, so I'm about halfway through.
Okay. I guess I didn't finish that thought. Like, when, as I watched later when we talked about it, and I watched not the most recent, but I think the one before that, I was just super engaged, and it got to the end, and I'm like, this show is just fantastic.
Yeah. I'm there already. I keep kind of gushing over it every week, but I don't want to give spoilers, but something happened where a young person attacked an older person. I will say this, right? At kind of almost out of the blue to prove themselves, and it ended on that, and it caused, like, it's going to cause the biggest thing in the whole show. So I'm like, oh, I really wanted to watch the next one, but it was like 1:30 in the morning already. I was like, gotta pay attention to this one. But is it all the way over? There's 9 episodes right now. I can't remember if it was supposed to be 10.
I think there's one more.
Okay, cool, good. I'm halfway through then.
I think there's supposed to be 10, and there have been 9.
Okay, cool.
So there's one more.
Another thing I did do yesterday, which is not news, not worth talking about a lot, but I watched Dune 2 again. I think it's the fourth time I watched it. I went to watch it with somebody who hadn't seen it before, but saw Dune 1, and we've been talking about going to it for a while, and they just hadn't had the time, and I was like, man, you really should go watch this in the theater, as I've said before. And every time, you know, we think it was the last time that it's going to have it in the theater, it was out another week, and this is just one of those, like, you know what, we have time, let's go watch it. And we did, and I watched it in Indianapolis. People who listen to the show know I'm located south of that in Bloomington, Indiana, but only an hour drive up there. And it's one of my favorite theaters it's an AMC theater, but it's one of the my favorite theaters around here. And it, because Dune 2 has been out for so long, it's in what you might consider their one of their worst theaters, because, you know, the older show goes, the worst theater it's in. And I also saw Dune, the last time I saw Dune 2 before was in Bloomington with you in the Bloomington Worst Theater.
And which we talked about at length.
Which we did talk about in length. And when I watched it with you in that theater, I enjoyed it because I'd seen it twice before and I appreciated the story and things that were going on, and it wasn't just about the sound, but I absolutely knew that the sound in the picture was like almost home quality levels in the Bloomington. So I had forgotten, and I went back to watched it yesterday, and even in that crappy theater up there, it's so incredibly better. And just really makes me sad about the state of my city's theater. It's just so unbelievably subpar. And watching it in what would be considered by the rest of America a medium quality theater at its lowest thing was still phenomenal. And the sound was so good and hit in certain things. And the person that I watched it with got, you could see visibly emotional on so many things. And I was able to kind of pick up on that as I was, because I'd seen it before, right? I knew what was happening. I knew the things.
Right.
And could see, oh, this is an important scene. This is something that's going to happen. And then recognize the music building, watching it hit, and then doing huge dissonant chords to make you feel a certain way. And then seeing that reaction of that person, like gasp or hold their breath or, you know, just kind of clench in type stuff. I'm like, that is the sound doing that, and the music, the sound and the music doing that kind of thing. Because I watched it without that crazy sound, and it was just a fine, greatly acted, good done scene. But now having this all wraparound sound was just incredible. Anyway, not to point more about Dune 2 or brag more about that thing, but it was just another, like, oh man, I'm glad I got to see this, even though it was the fourth time, because unless they re-release it 20 years later or something, I won't be able to fully experience, even with a theater kind of set up at home, that experience. And still phenomenal.
Right.
Film. But anyway, we watched, let's not go to our show yet. Let's talk about game first. Tuesday, we had some people missing on our regular game night, and it whittled down to just you, myself, and our buddy Trotsky. And we decided to take our time, eat some dinner, chat a bit, and then we pulled out a new game that he had called Wormspan. And it's a sequel. Is that what I want to say? Sequel to, or successor or something to, the game Wingspan.
Wingspan, right? Stonemaier Games.
Stonemaier Games. Okay, good. Yeah. And had you played Wingspan before Wormspan?
Yeah, I played Wingspan. I don't know if I ever played it in person, but it's on Board Game Arena, and we've played it on there a couple times. It's fine. It's an engine builder. It was very popular
very
the year
popular,
it came out. I think for a number of reasons we talked about this Tuesday. Like, it's not super complicated, but it's also not basic. Like, it's not a game right game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more advanced than that, but it's non-confrontational. The board and the art are very pretty, with all the birds and the little wooden eggs and all of those things. And so I think that makes it like a family game with a decent amount of depth.
Yes.
Right. And complexity. So like a 2.5 or a 3 out of 5, if I had to guess, while still being more accessible than a game where there's a lot of fighting and competition and take that. I mean, even games that don't have fighting, like Settlers of Catan or Ticket to Ride, still have a racing thing where you're, you know, somebody will cut you off from the route that you need or the harbor that you want to get to. to complete your to build your town, your settlement in Catan or something like that. And Wingspan doesn't have any of that. I mean, I think there's probably some kind of competition over the resources, and the biggest, well, there are several big changes. Not say big changes. There are several changes from Wingspan to Wormspan, one of which is doing away with the limited resource pool.
Yeah. Thank goodness.
That Wingspan has, which is like, you roll these dice and those are the food
yep.
types that are available if you want to, collect food as your action.
Mm-hmm.
In Wormspan, there are just pools of tokens and you can buy whatever you need at any point.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good change.
I agree. I think, our buddy Trotsky, when we were talking about it, had said that that was a touch point, the Wingspan version where you had limited resources and you had to, or to pick from on your resource in the available resource pool was meant to be a way that a touch point of character player interaction, right? Like, oh, I better get this before they get this, or, they took it and, you know, I want to take it before they can get something. But right. Because that game Wingspan had very, very, very little player interaction at all. And you're basically playing a solo game with scoring at the end that you see who got the highest score mm-hmm. from that. So they try to add in just little bitty bits of interaction. But it's also, I think that's why some people liked Wingspan, was that you didn't have other people getting in the way of your stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if you're playing, I mean, I can attest to this. Like my family, most of my family can play Ticket to Ride.
Yeah.
But some of them that don't play a lot of games will get upset if, like, one time they asked me, because I wasn't playing, but I walked by, and one of them said, is it cheating if you just start putting down trains to make the game end faster because you finished all your routes? And I'm like, that is not even a little bit cheating.
That is.
Almost. And they're like, who asked you anyway? Sorry. Like, but are just like potentially more sensitive to that kind of competition.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like people who would never even touch Risk.
Right.
But still want to play a family game. And not that, you know, with my family, like not there can't be competition. Like we talked about, Bananagrams, that's a racing game, but whatever. Anyway,
yeah. Well, in Wormspan, they don't have too much more competition than Wingspan does. They add a new element called the Guild, I think is what it's called. And when
that round thing,
yeah, as you move, like you just play cards that you happen to have, they'll have a little guild symbol on them, and there's an extra piece, an extra like mini board, and you have your little player pieces on it that goes around a circle, and on parts around that circle, steps, like think of like a sorry, like a sorry board or something. And as you go around,
it's like a clock.
Yeah, like a clock. And as you get up, like play one of the symbols, you move around the clock, and then in every step, you get a resource that's on there. You know, whatever resource might be. And there are like two spots around it that if you're there, you get to be the first one to pick some kind of special reward that can no longer be picked by anyone else. So that is an incentive to kind of do something before somebody else does. That's a player interaction. So they took away the resource thing where, you know, you're limited and you have to fight for that. But then they added this one in, where you kind of compete for these. But it's also, you're only competing really for those two extra spots on the wheel to get there first. So they did keep in that minimal amount of player interaction, but also kept it very, very minimal and almost, I might say, inconsequential. Yes, there are some points that you can get victory points there, but everyone's going to kind of get around just naturally and get some points off that board anyway.
Right.
So it's very negligible. Our game ended up relatively close, and I don't think that any of us knew how close we were, right? I think we thought that our buddy Mike was like racing away with the game, and then I was something like 4 or 5 points behind him at the end, and then you were right behind it with points that we didn't even see and thought you were far, far behind, and then you were right there with it at the end. So,
yeah, I did something. Some of the dragons that I, because that's the theme, right? Instead of birds, you have dragons.
Right.
The mechanic that I don't say didn't appreciate. I didn't appreciate because I didn't understand it at the beginning.
Yeah.
And by the time I did understand it, it was too late. It's that kind of, you know, we've talked at length about how I feel about being trapped at the table.
Yeah, yeah.
It's probably a little bit of ADHD or something. But it's played in 4 rounds, and in each round, there's a specific kind of scoring. And it's determined by these tiles, and there's a box or bag of them, and you pull them randomly. And so it's different every game, right, to get replayability. And in our game, well, the details don't matter, but the tiles would be like, you know, play this size of dragon. And just like the birds, the dragons are in different sizes, from hatchlings up to large or huge or something.
Yeah.
Have dragons with this icon on them, or have dragons that cost at least 3 resources. And at the end of each round, you look at everybody's boards, and whoever has the most of whatever that is gets a certain amount of points, and then second place, third place, fourth place. And I did not realize that those were round scoring and not for the whole game. So I was doing things in round one that I'm like, oh, I'm going to eventually, like, I haven't drawn any hatchling cards, but you know, I'll want to have some hatchlings later, not realizing that once round one was over, those hatchlings didn't matter at all.
Yeah.
Like that scoring was done. And then I think the second time I thought I was doing what it was like open caves. Cause they have this cave open there's a second set of square cards that you have to put on the spaces before you can put dragons on them. That's another thing that's different from Wingspan.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm doing okay with these. And then as we got closer to the end of the round, like, you both had almost twice as many as me. And I was like, okay, I'm too far behind. I've already lost, but I have to sit here for another 2 hours because the two of you are some of the most analysis paralysis, slow turn taking people in our friend group. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but
I was not too far off the mark.
I was in full pessimism spiral at that point in the game.
But that being said, it's important to note that you were close, and that is kind of what I was trying to say here, is that it was hard to tell who was winning and why, because you're not interacting or looking at their boards really, you know.
Yeah, that round scoring thing, I guess that's a thing in Wingspan too, but I've not played enough Wingspan to remember it. That's a very, it's not interactive, but it's a way where, it's a way that the game is not solitaire. Like, you have to be paying attention to what the other players are doing, because it's not huge. Like, it's not the main scoring mechanic.
Yeah.
But it's pretty significant.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say more so than like being the first to get to the 6 point bonus on the guild.
Yeah, absolutely. Thing. Right. For sure. Yeah. I just wish if I had a downside, I thought the game was fine. I like it just as much as like Wingspan, which is just okay as well.
Right.
But honestly, I can play those solo and probably get just as much fun out of them. I'm not anti like solitaire mechanics in games or type games, because I often get high anxiety at games that have very limited or a lot of interaction that relies on everybody else doing stuff, because I really want to do a thing. And then I'm just super anxiety riddled all the way around the board until, you know, while everybody else is taking their turn, maybe they're going to take my space or take the one resource I need to make it work. And then,
right.
then it just spirals me down into this. Oh, they took it, they did it on purpose, and you did were intentional when it wasn't. And then I get frustrated and try to plan something else, and then somebody else derails it. It really frustrates me more. So having a game where you don't have to, other people can't screw you up, should be something I like. This one is fine because of that. It just, I don't know. It didn't feel like Wingspan. Doesn't feel exciting. Like I'm really building my engine and it's really cool and all the pieces come together to make this really neat thing. It's just not. It's, you know, you get some eggs, you lay them on your board, you pay for them to get another dragon out, to get another egg, to get, you know, and then you get to the end and you're like, oh, cool, I get now victory points. And it's just, I don't know, just there was no puzzle. When you're playing a solo type game, you kind of want to figure out the puzzle to do the best or most efficient. And this one just didn't have a lot of that one.
Yeah, I don't know. And like, I got really into Earth, which is a similar game to both of these, where it's, you know, it's got a sort of theme. I think the theme is a little more well realized in Earth than in Wingspan. In Wormspan, the theme is maybe a little more realized than in Wingspan, but not a lot. Right? Like, it's still just mechanics.
Yes.
And Earth is that way too, right? There's a decent amount of like actual botany knowledge put into, you know, which plants have which things and synergize in which ways, but it's still a lot of mechanics in that same engine builder kind of way. And I don't know what it is about that game that made it click for me better than either of these. I mean, maybe it's just more like you do more, you take more actions.
Yeah.
Because of the follow mechanic. And so it just felt more like I'm doing more things. I'm more engaged. I mean, maybe a little bit like Last Light, which I haven't played, but has a similar kind of idea, right? In Earth, I mean, you've played Earth, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, multiple times.
Yeah, right. So you do, like, I pick a thing and then everybody gets to do something because of that, and maybe they get to do several somethings because of however they've built their engine, where in Wingspan and Wormspan, like, I'm sitting around if it's not my turn.
Yeah. Because,
you know, I could leave. I could get up from the table and leave. And a lot of times I like that in games. But I don't know. In this one, just didn't, it didn't click. It wasn't bad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I had a bad time, but that was mostly me, not the game.
Yeah, and I think the recommended four type thing is if you liked Wingspan, which I almost kind of don't like that, because sometimes people will say, well, I didn't play that other one. How do I know if I'd like this one? I don't want to go back and play the other one to learn if I like this one or not.
Sure.
I get that kind of, don't I like the reviews, but Wingspan was a popular game that a lot of people have played in modern times, in the last, I don't know, how 3 years or so, whenever Wingspan came out.
I want to say like 21 or two. It's not very old.
Right. So if you're in that crowd that liked that one and loved Wingspan, then Wormspan is definitely that, with a dragon exterior instead of birds, and adds a few mechanics but takes some old annoying ones away. But a lot of it is so much the same. It's very, very similar to the exact same game. Okay. Thumbs up, but I give it a 5 out of 10. You know, maybe.
Wingspan was 2019. It's longer ago than
longer
I thought.
Than I thought, so yeah.
And it's and its weight is 2.46, so just a little under what I guessed.
Yeah.
Wormspan's weight is 2.7, which I think tracks, like, the extra the guild circle and the cave mechanic make it a little more
complicated. Yeah, they add that little cave mechanic. Yeah, before you put a bird down, I mean, a dragon down, you have to actually put another card down before it. It's kind of like double dragging it, whatever, if you think of it that way, or birding it.
Yeah, I mean that, who knows? I was too exhausted by the time we were done to really, really analyze it. But I think I could have been closer to winning had I not forgotten in my last turn that I needed another cave before I could play one of the dragons. Like, I had a bunch of big point-scoring dragons, and I couldn't play the last one because I didn't have enough of the coins you use to take actions.
Yeah.
To both open a cave and play the dragon on that cave.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that would have given me another 6 or 8 points or something, which I probably wouldn't have made me win, but I might have got second place instead of last.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is that, and I don't mean this as any kind of pick on you at all, is that you're halfway through the game feeling that you weren't winning and kind of like zoning out. You were probably winning, very close to winning at that point. And then had there been something in the game to keep you engaged with that, or actually I think the real problem.
I mean, I kept trying and I didn't win, so I wasn't wrong.
Yeah, no, no. What I was trying to get at there is that the game's major fault, and we'll say this the last thing with this game, is that you don't really know how everyone's doing. And
sure,
I can look at this guy's board over there and he's got a lot of pieces all out on it, and I think that's a winning thing, and maybe not, because they all have no points on their worm, on their dragons, and they're all super cheap costs and stuff. And I look at mine and it has nothing, but I've got really expensive dragons and they're high point getters or end game point salad getters. You know, there's just no way to see it. It makes me realize that games that have the tracker around the board as you go are very helpful. I'm thinking of
Ticket to Ride.
Yeah, Ticket to Ride, things like that. Granted, there's a lot of those games that also have point salad at the end, so not as helpful.
Yeah, that's a big, and I understand why games do that. Like, Catan doesn't do that, but you also have to like look on the board and count, and there are hidden victory point cards. But it's just like, here, 10 points, you know, I win. That's it. It's over.
Yeah.
I understand why games have hidden scoring, right? It's supposed to combat the any of the psychological things that go along with stuff like, not Kingmaker, but whatever the opposite of Kingmaker is, where someone's ahead and everybody gangs up on them. Like, I think games should have that, yeah. Right? That's a sort of built-in psychological catch-up mechanic.
Yeah.
Sort of, or can be. But the thing you described where, you know, it's very obvious that someone, you know, one person is winning and another kind of person might, you know, just kind of give up at that point.
Yeah.
And if you hide the scores, you kind of combat that a little bit. I don't think it's...
Yeah, the Ticket to Ride Legacy is trying hard to do that. We'll see how it comes out at the end. You do know your scores, but you tuck everything away in a card for the end of the legacy part and the campaign. And then you get stocks, but you don't know. Then you fulfill certain objectives, but you don't know. So you just put it in the box. And they're trying to do, you can tell in that game that they're trying to make you feel each week is different. You can stand a chance type stuff. But it's frustrating to not know if we're close or not at all.
Right.
And yeah, we'll still play because we will, but the competition goes almost out of it because of the thing we just had, like you had, that same exact problem is that we all think in our specific game that Justin's winning by a whole lot, but I don't know. Right. I think so. He's lost several games that by a lot of points, but there's just no way to tell. And I know that people are going to say, well, then just keep playing your best, son, you know. But, you know, do I need a chance? Do I need to really put, it's like gambling without knowing that, you know, do I gamble on taking big routes? Do I gamble on taking big points or play conservatively? You don't know. You have no idea. And I'm not a fan of not knowing things in a game you're playing. That's sure. General things. All right. So anyway, moving off of that one, I played Terraforming Mars for the first time. Actually, I played it 3 times this last week. well, once I'm still playing the first game I started, it's with two other friends. We're all learning it. And then I saw that you could play it solo on Board Game Arena. And I have no idea what was going on. I mean, I watched the video and stuff, but I had no idea any kind of strategy. So I decided to play solo just to screw with it and figure it out.
Sure.
And I think I like it. I don't want to go into too much of the details of it because I don't even know what kind of game it is. Maybe engine building. But
I've never played it, so I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. If you've heard about it, or you're wondering what, you know, Terraforming Mars is, you obviously go look it up. I'm not going to go into it too much here. I just wanted to mention it because it is a thing that a lot of people play. It is a thing that, you know, people said, oh, well, we'll pick this one out, or, you know, it's notable, I guess. And my only comment on it is that I understand it. I see it. I like it and enjoy it. It's a game that's going to, that takes at several playthroughs to understand what you should be doing or how you're doing it. And if a card is good or not, you know, do I, let's say, get 1 point to my engine every round? Is that good? What's a, you know, like sometimes when you say you get one victory point a round, okay, what's the point spread at the end of the game? Is it 1,000 points or is it 5 points? You know, so in that case, getting 1 point a round is a big thing, but you just don't know until you play it multiple times. And I said, I've played it 3 times now. And I think I finally get a handle on the turn by turn what I should be doing and can be doing. And I like it now that it's kind of like Earth in that way. I know it. I kind of understand what I'm supposed to do. And I just kind of go for that thing because that's what I understand of the game. But it took me a long time to get there. And Terraforming Mars in real life, I guess, is a long game. So it's not like you're...
I think that's true.
Yeah. Board Game Arena speeds things up a whole lot.
Sure.
So, yeah, I do give it a thumbs up. It is what I would think is my kind of game. And if I played it often, and I will actually play the solo version because it's pretty enjoyable. I can try lots of stuff. It's the solo versus the multiplayer has a timer in it. I mean, you only have 14 rounds. That's your timer in a multiplayer. It's until everyone does all the objectives type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can play through it solo in a relatively quickly way. I'd say 30 minutes, being a little thoughtful for my stuff, my turns. But a real life game takes a lot more. So I don't know how that plays into it. But the game itself, thumbs up. I like it better than Wormspan. I'll say that much. But Wormspan is way more accessible. You can learn it in the first go. Maybe play it the second time we play it, we blow through it without problem. Terraforming Mars takes a lot. Okay. See if we want to go into. Let's talk about some news things. Kind of news things. You see that new trailer dropped today for Daredevil and Wolverine?
Do you mean Deadpool and Wolverine?
Oh, I said Daredevil. Deadpool. They're the same. No, they're not at all. Yeah, Deadpool. I like that it's called Deadpool and Wolverine, not Deadpool versus or V or X.
Sure.
Because they're supposedly on the same team.
Right, right.
Did you like the Deadpool movies at all?
Yeah. Yeah. They're I watching the trailer, I wanted to kind of praise the franchise, this Ryan Reynolds franchise for its sort of mirth, I guess. But I do think that you can get diminishing returns with that stuff.
Like, yeah,
I
think
that happened to the Guardians franchise. Like, yes. At a certain point, like, it's silly enough. Now, Deadpool has a different kind of silly than the Guardians movies, right? Because it's, you know, it's very bloody, it's very violent, it's full of profanity. Like, it's a different... There's some... kind of black comedy or dark, maybe it's dark comedy you're supposed to call it now, like you know, that kind of balances out the goofiness and the meta jokes of fourth wall breaking.
Yeah.
You know, there's a, in the trailer he says something about Feige, right?
Yeah. It's the cocaine they can't have any
the cocaine drug that's use. Right, yeah. That's right. And they did that in one of the shows, one of the streamers And I don't remember which one. Do you remember that?
I don't. Oh yeah, it's She-Hulk.
She-Hulk.
Yeah.
It's a robot, Kevin Feige.
Yeah,
Like, it's not really, but
She-Hulk.
like,
She broke the
there's a.
fourth wall in the last episode, or multiple times. She would look at the camera and speak. The character would.
Yeah. I've mostly forgotten everything about that
Yeah,
show, but
fully.
I
The
remember
only
that
reason I
now.
remembered is I read an article while, or read some comments today about this film or this trailer, and it mentioned her. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. She had fourth wall breaks, but I forgot. And I even forgot that Feige thing until you just said it. But yeah, I will say that the trailer properly got me excited for it. The first one I was pretty excited for. I've been on record as saying, man, I don't want to put that goofy Wolverine outfit in it. Yeah, he'll look cool. It's fine. And I like it because I'm a fan.
I thought that watching the trailer, because I watched it after you like re responded reacted positively to it, and I was like, oh, Michael liked it despite the Wolverine looking like Wolverine that he
Yeah, looking
hates.
like a big goofball. But what helps is that this is a multiverse film, and
Right.
I think it's going to be fantastic because there's no way that he's not going to just make fun of all the Marvel multiverse stuff a lot. And
Right.
I am ready for that. Like, we all are so exhausted of that, and it's fine. I've always said it before, it's fine for a couple movies or shows or whatever, but it gets old real
Yeah,
fast.
when it was a new, like, oh, maybe they're gonna do multiverse, but like, I don't know. I feel like every time the MCU has dabbled in multiverse stories, they've been bad.
Yeah, and some of the problem with it is that I was reading this again, just recently, is it's good to do multiverse once or twice. But if you start doing it regularly, or you introduce multiverses into your regular, let's say, comic book or movies or TV series thing, then you lose all stakes.
All the stakes,
Yeah,
yeah.
because someone dies. Okay, that's just one universe. Great, that's a great story. I mean, I can't go back to the DC complaint all the time. This is the DC world, is how their entire comic lines are this way. Every other comic is a different universe, basically. And so you don't, Superman dies. Okay, no big deal. It's not like Superman's not going to have six other comics that he didn't die in. So it doesn't have a lot of stakes to it. And
Yeah,
yeah.
it's the wrong like and I don't know from comics, but I feel like the wrong way to do the multiverse is to just like replace a character, right? Like put in, I mean, maybe you put in a new actor, right? Like
Yeah.
that's a thing you can do. But the one of the quote unquote right ways that you can use multiverse is stuff like Supergirl and Power Girl, right? Like
Yeah.
those are different characters,
Right.
like maybe a similar origin story, but because of the multiverse thing. And then of course we can't talk about multiverse without mentioning Everything Everywhere All at Once, which
Yeah.
did something more interesting and cool with multiverses than multiple universes than any superhero movie.
Any or anything, yeah, like for sure. It's top of the top. Yeah. Moving off from the multiverse thing, I just kind of want to go back and
Yeah,
say
we
that
got sidetracked.
Deadpool is a multiverse movie, and it does a couple things. Is one, that it's going to make fun of them, which is great.
Sure, of course.
Also, hopefully, it will push Marvel to wrap up their multiverse saga way earlier than they thought. I think that's their plan anyway, but I'm not sure. In comic books, both the Marvel and DC in past generations have figured out that the multiverse problem is dumb. And what do they say? This has all happened before, this will all happen again. And they keep every 10 years making the same mistake, because they come back and say, oh, it's gone so out of control that we're just going to have one big thing where they come back together and it'll unify all the multiverses, and we can all just pay attention to one from now on again, because it's got crazy. And then they get different editors and stuff, and they start losing track of the lessons they learned, and it all goes crazy again. Well, that's what Marvel needs to do in their MCU, is They have planned called Secret Wars. In DC, it's called
Crisis
stuff, right? Something. It's always Crisis of something. And so Marvel needs to do their Secret Wars, where all of the worlds kind of come together, smash together with incursions, and then it just, you end up with the primary thing and don't worry about that. They just need to do that to end it. And I think that Deadpool's going to just make fun of it, make it happen, and push it forward, because he's dealing with the TVA. He's all involved with that. The last thing about that with the multiverse with Deadpool is that he is going to usher in Fox and all of their X-Men and things like that into the primary Marvel world.
MCU, sure.
Yeah, and this is a neat creative way to do it. You're taking a character that is not in the MCU, and it looks like it's not even the Deadpool that we've watched from the last two movies. It's an alternate universe Deadpool. Yeah, because if you see in both of the two trailers that are out, Vanessa, his girlfriend's alive. And she, spoilers for those movies, died. And it was the whole plot of the second movie, is that she's dead. And
yeah, but also, at the end of two, he takes the guy, the angry guy who's chasing him, whose name I've forgotten. He takes his watch thing and goes back and undoes everything, right?
Does he undo Vanessa? I don't think he does. Because there's a big emotional scene, which makes Deadpool great too, because he actually does have emotional scenes, is where he dies and he goes and like to the afterlife. And there's a scene where he kind of crosses over the barrier he can never cross over, sees Vanessa. And then she tells him that it's not his time, that her time is there and she'll see him soon. He jerks away from the afterlife and then goes back. I'll have to watch that one again, because you're right. I remember at the end on the credits tag, whatever, he's going back in time and changing things.
Yeah, I think he like contemplates it for a couple minutes and he's like, screw it.
And he might.
Goes back and saves her.
Well, in these trailers,
maybe I'm
all of the people that died in Deadpool 2 are alive again. And so that kind of, it would, if that happened, he basically just canceled Deadpool 2. Because all the X-Force people in one scene, again, we're behind the bell here, all die, except for Domino, all in one scene. And in the birthday celebration we see in these two trailers, they're there celebrating with him.
Right.
So either he does go back and change time, which, by the way, the TVA might be the reason, that might be the reason why the TVA pull him out.
Oh, he's a variant.
Yeah, he's a variant. There you go.
Is that the word?
So this is probably a variant, or aka multiverse Deadpool, and that Deadpool is going to bring over. So it's not even the Fox one. It is, but isn't. It's a way for Marvel. I think it's a neat way for Marvel and Deadpool and Ryan Reynolds to say, this is the Deadpool that you know, but a different Deadpool, and we're going to put this guy without ties to the Fox past that you have to have, 100%. Same thing with Wolverine. This Wolverine is not the Wolverine that we've seen in the Fox franchise.
Yeah, that part I got, because he's wearing the right suit.
Yeah, he's wearing that suit, which is what made me okay with it. Because if there's a infinite multiverses, there's clearly going to be a multiverse that's just where he's wearing that suit and he's goofy looking.
Right.
So, and it's a perfect thing in the movie Deadpool to bring goofy things together. So, what better? Yeah. Way to usher that goofy suit in than Deadpool. So anyway, I liked it. Thumbs up. I want to say a little interjection. I'm watching the X-Men series. Not X-Men 97, but I'm watching the actual X-Men animation from cartoon from 97. Before I watch X-Men 97. I'm very close to the last season of it. There's not a whole lot. They're half-hour shows. I don't know, 10 to 12 a season or something like that. Not a ton. I say it is definitely a kid's show, but I really, really like, because I've read all these stories back when they were in the comics, and they are taking like an event of X-Men that took a year in comics to tell, and they just distill it down to, 20 minutes and you just tell the whole story in 20 minutes and just run through it. You know, oh, Gene likes Scott. They're in love. They say, I love you, Gene. And then they move on to the next thing. There's none of this, will they, won't they, or angst or something like that. Just kind of, they just hit the high points and go through. And they don't need to be in depth or everything. They just, they are what they are. And kids liked it. So I appreciate it. It's very light. And I'm looking forward to X-Men 97, the actual ones to watch. But, you know, I just like it from a standpoint of, it's just like the old 80s comic books, the cartoon is. So good on them for,
right.
You know, Wolverine's really, really goofy. Just really over the top, silly. And so are all the characters, like a kid's show would be. All right, moving onward. Let's talk about our show this week.
All right. This week we watched The Barbarians from 1987 from Canon. And no, the YouTube video I watched was like, it's another one of these, and his channel is all good bad movies. I think that's the name of the channel.
Yeah.
And so he's watched, I think, some of these others and is going to watch everything this studio made.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I think this was one of a string of films that came after Conan.
100%.
The Barbarian.
Absolutely did, yes.
I never saw that, but yeah, this is starring David and Peter Paul. That's just a
Is there three of them? You said there's three of them? David, Peter,
Bible
and Paul.
First name. Paul is their last name, and then David and Peter. Bodybuilders who maybe became known as the Barbarian Brothers. I think this was their first film.
Right.
And clearly, to me anyway, this film... And I don't think that's just me. I think the guy in the YouTube video said it too. Clearly, this film was trying to set up a franchise, right? Just making a bunch of movies like the Godzilla movies or the Hercules movies or all that kind of stuff. I don't know if there were Hercules movies. There's a TV show for sure.
Yeah.
Where they're just like, here are these guys. We're going to, you know, now we'll make up some new inane story to put them in that's... you know, like this movie was 60% action sequences, I think.
Oh, that's generous. If not generous, that's
understatement.
Understatement. Yeah. Yes. That's the word I'm looking for. Conan the Barbarian, which I have on our list, to watch is also, there's the sequel called Conan the Destroyer. And then later on, Jason Momoa did a kind of a reboot of it with Conan. And they are just what you just explained. They're like, he goes on an adventure and does a thing. And it's not like it's an overall story or anything. It's just Conan's in the world, comes up with some bad guys that have a bad thing they want to do. And he's there and stops them or does his own thing or whatever.
Right.
And yeah, that 100% you see how Conan made it a franchise. Granted, just with two movies. But yeah, this one did the same thing in the same kind of way. And could have made out. Only thing is, it's not a great film in any way, shape, or form, I guess.
No,
well,
it's,
no, I'm saying anyway. It's good. It's good, bad. But yeah,
it's good, bad. I think the best you can say about this film is if you enjoy watching these guys like be just goofballs for 90 minutes. That's what this movie is.
I thought about that as I was watching. I was like, are they just modern goofy, like, or 80s goofy? Is that what they are? It's happening here. And then it dawned on me that this is clearly a world where everyone has an IQ of like 100 or some kind of like really low. They're all incredibly dumb.
Sure.
With the, I don't know. What's the girl? What's her name? It's the person, the girl that comes with them.
Kara, Ismene,
yeah.
Ava LaRue is the actress.
She's the only one that seems to like have a little bit moderate level of intelligence, which makes her extremely bright in this world.
Yeah, to an extent where she seems out of place in this movie.
Completely out of place. Right.
Her writing and her dialogue was just completely modern, where everybody else was doing some kind of, it's not medieval because there's dragons and a little bit of magic. It's I guess you call this sword and sorcery.
Yes, 100%. It
reminded me a little bit of Willow, though Willow is better than this.
Yeah.
And she's just a normal modern person. Like, her wardrobe fits the rest of the ridiculous cheap fur and leather wardrobe everybody else is wearing. But I wish I could remember the line, but she delivers some idiom that I'm like, that doesn't belong. Like, you need trains or ships or steam engines or something for that idiom to make any sense. But it doesn't, I mean, this is not that kind of movie.
Yeah. No, definitely not that kind of movie. Yeah. I just want to repeat again, they're all so imbecilic. Like, the bad guys, mm-hmm. the good guys, the townspeople, any single person that comes on the screen is really, really dumb. And if you're like, okay, you take the dumbest people you've ever met back in middle school or high school, and I mean like low IQ, and then you're like, go make a movie in your backyard and have somebody film it, and just kind of, also the director's that way too. Director's a really dumb person that just makes whatever kind of decisions, and give them a camera and say, go make a thing. This is the film. They're all imbeciles. And and that's funny. That's funny. That's what makes it good, bad, right? Is that, like, this is so unbelievably kooky and their lines are bad. And they argue some, there's like one thing that I liked. One thing that I thought was a fun thing and enjoyed was when the brothers do the, hey, I want that sword. And then he plays with it. Like, he sees him playing with the axe and he says, no, I want the axe. And then he's good. I always like the sword for it better. And they do it, that gag, like two or three times. And I'm like, okay.
It reminded me, I mean, and that's part of what I mean, is just them being goofballs.
Just goofballs.
But I wonder if the probably not, but it almost feels like the bit in Endgame when Cap and Thor, spoilers for Avengers Endgame, when Cap and Thor are fighting with Mjolnir and the axe that he made. He's
saying,
like, no, you take the little one, yeah. Right? It's just like a little bit of like goofiness in the middle of this epic fight,
right?
At the end of that movie,
but that's this whole show, right?
That's this whole movie, yeah,
yeah. I'm not taking any kind of credit for the things I'm getting ready to say here, because I do have IMDb up in front of me. I would not know these people's real names, but there's a guy named Dirt Master. He's played by an actor named Michael Berryman. He is the guy with the big horn on his head, the bad guy.
The Dirt Master, yeah.
Yeah, Dirt Master. And they're just like, I've seen him in other things. He's got a weird kind of face to him. I've seen him in a lot of other movies in the 80s and 90s. And they do a whole lot of that, where they got this weird, completely weird makeup on people's faces. And it's just so terrible that you just like, you can't even think that it's laughable. And also, remember I said the idiot thing? The costume designers are the same way. They put a lot of effort and time into it. So there's a ton of costumes. No one is wearing the same kind of clothes. That weird dragon thing, we're going to say it's a air quote dragon.
The turtley looking dragon
thing. They put time and effort. And I know this has to be on a shoestring budget. So there's probably like a crew of five people that did all of this entire set. All the sets. They're probably, someone who made movies back in the 50s and was, liquored up the whole time and given instructions to his, 17-year-old helpers to make this whole film. And it shows a lot.
According to IMDb, $4 million budget.
Oh, in 87, that's probably respectable.
It's kind of a lot. And worldwide gross, 800,000, which maybe explains why it didn't have any sequels.
800,000. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And it is, I don't want to look bag on people who, trying their hardest to make their name in Hollywood, but these guys just weren't made for this. They did not do anything noteworthy afterwards in Hollywood.
they have a handful of other movies that are all like 4, 4.6, 5.5. No, I don't think this one's even that. Like, just a bunch of like 5 out of 10 star movies.
Yeah, and it's not just that everyone associated with the film is also terrible, because they are. So sometimes you can say, what's that show we're watching, Shogun, and the monster one with Godzilla and
Monarch,
and we talked about how the girl in that one is good in one, but not in the other, because it's got a bad directors or writers or things. This isn't the case. These guys are also not great, and they do a lot of things that sometimes I'm wondering if they're just like hanging around on the set during a scene, yeah, and the director's filming, yeah, and they're like, oh yeah, we're shooting. Just, oh, okay, sure.
Just screwing around. Yeah.
Just screwing around doing nothing. But okay. All that said, bagging on it, I liked it because it's bad good. The real question when I picked this one was, is it a bad good? It sits at a 46% in Rotten Tomatoes, which to me means it's going to be bad, bad.
Sure.
You know, that it's not so bad that it's, you want to watch it all the time. But for me, I would watch this again on a group watching when you had a little bit too much to drink, or where it's legal in parts of the country where you've partaken of some edibles, perhaps. Mm-hmm. This would be a, not that I'm condoning any of those things on our podcast here, but you're in an altered state, let's put it that way. Sure. Then this would be a really funny thing to watch, because even the action scenes are just really bad. Like the final scene they do against him, the bad guy on a horse, and I have no idea what's happening for 15 minutes.
I didn't even connect this together, but the only reason that he can't shoot them with that crossbow is because they bit his fingers off in the first act.
Oh, okay. I did not even know that. I had no idea.
Right. He tries to pull the trigger and is like, oh, he forgot. He's missing like his first two fingers on his right hand. Like, how do you forget?
And he's been that way like for 15 years, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. The entire, like, that they grew up and nobody else aged.
Nobody else aged.
They're little boys at the beginning of the movie, and everybody else looks exactly the same. There's no attempt at age makeup
or to explain it or to do anything. And then when people die, it's just seemingly like, what? Like the sorceress dies, and you're like, okay. And then is Mina becomes the, I'm sorry, I'm spoiling this, guys, but she becomes the queen of something because her belly button thing gem fits, and she's the girl they mentioned at the very beginning, but we don't have any idea about why or anything. Just
yeah, and it's important that they got those neck tattoos, but none of the hippie traveling musicians remember the neck tattoos until after, like, they try to hang them and all of that stuff.
No, it's Mina. I mean,
I knew as soon as she dropped the root and it's like, oh, it turned back into a root. I'm like, were they making this up as they go along, this script? Oh, but fully, then as soon as that happens, I'm like, oh, obviously she's going to be the new queen now that Canary. The canary who the villain kept in a cage, right?
That's now. Okay,
clever, right. See? Like, does her magic thing and then gets stabbed anyway. I was like, what was the point of that?
That was so bad. She does magic and stands there while he's slicing at her.
Tries to stab her and then eventually does stab her.
Spoiler, and she's like, oh, you stabbed me. Now I'm free. I'm like, what? Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that you just said that they made this up as they go along. Maybe they did. Maybe it was like, today we're going to write this script and just do whatever. Right.
Just over a weekend, just hammer it out.
Just hammer this thing out. Wow, it's just really, really crazy. The I wanted to say about Ismina getting the thing. She is so fun. Eva LaRue is so fun to watch in this because of that modern person in this movie type juxtaposition they have all the time.
She doesn't know what kind of movie she's in.
No. In one scene where she goes and she tells them that they're going to go into a harem, and there's like this big boulder that rolled away or something. And she's like, by the way, these girls haven't had anybody in for a while. Wink, wink. And I'm like, what is happening here? And then she comes out and they're like, they do that donkey laugh that they do.
Yeah. One of the brothers does this donkey laugh thing like six times.
It's just so crazy. And Ismina, when she becomes the queen, she doesn't want to become, like, she doesn't want any of this. And she's like, no, stop, whatever. She has no connection at all to this group of hippies. And then they put her in her stomach and she says, "You're the chosen queen." And they're like, no, she can't be. And all of a sudden, on a dime, she changes, says, everything's okay. I'm one of you. Look at my tattoo. And she's like, yeah. What? And then they all get together and they push her up, throw her up in the air. And she smiles really big and throws her hands up like she's so happy. And I'm like, what the hell are you playing here, Evil LaRue? What's going on?
Yeah. And and don't forget the quintessential component of all cheesy 80s movies ended on a freeze frame.
It totally did too. Oh my god! Did you see when they had to? I didn't put this, but I'm going to mention it anyways. That when they were choosing queens, the first thing the temporary leader guy says is, "Bring me all the virgins."
Mm-hmm.
And then the two virgins that they had that it didn't fit, and then he's like, "Bring me this random new girl," and they're like, "But she's not a virgin." He's like, "Pay no attention to what I just said," or some kind of nonsense.
Yeah,
he just puts it in her belly button. He didn't try his wife. No, why didn't he try his wife or any other person that was
I don't know.
There's a lot of this movie that you can just they laugh just needed, about.
Yeah, and there were several things that I was like, not at the time, but thinking back on it now, I'm like, all right, they didn't have enough script. Like, this movie's not very long. It's 94 minutes long or something like that.
And they got a $4 million budget.
87 minutes long. It's less than an hour and a half long. Oh. And I was like, they don't have any lines for this. There's no script. There's not enough script to make this. Like, somehow they had to get from the point of Canary dying to Kara being the new queen, or they don't call her queen, but something like that.
No, I think they actually do. They don't call her queen until the very end when they decide now they have a queen, which is weird.
I feel like she had a different title, but whatever.
Maybe, okay.
And so they're like, okay, well, let's do this thing with virgins where we test to see if the belly button, the magic ruby stays in the belly button, and it doesn't, and they're distraught. And they're like, okay, well, let's try this girl who's an outsider, and what, it's just like, the movie has to get to a point where she is the new canary. So, like, they're just going to try it and there's like a moment of protest and whatever. Similar thing to when the villain is first introduced and he's got the sword and he keeps like fake swing, like he's going to swing and hit some, and then just laughing. There's like 5 straight minutes of that, of him like almost stab one of the gypsies and then laughs his maniacal evil laugh. I'm like, oh, you can tell, you know, mine is an evil laugh, because he's just laughing, like so much laughing. And like, there's just, again, thinking back at the time, I was like, it's weird that he's laughing so much. But now thinking back, I'm like, they didn't have any other dialogue for him to say. They're like, he's evil. There's no more information we need him to convey. Let's just have him do an evil laugh. And then he'll fake out again. And then he'll laugh some more. And the fake out happens like 5 times. And then he just straight up stabs a woman. And they're like, oh, that's just, okay. We weren't sure if he was the villain. But now we definitely know.
There's a shot, talking about just the absurdity of this film. There's a shot when the sorceress gets the gem, gets the ruby. And like out of the statue or some kind of thing, she pulls it out, and then there's storms seem to be happening everywhere, or lightning or something, and they switch a shot over to that evil bad guy, and he's sitting on his throne. Now, if you ever get to watch this thing again, guys, watch this scene, because the throne is it's a chair on top of a gigantic square platform that's about 20 feet by 20 feet,
big
square,
big dais,
and it's sitting on top of a pyramid, like with a point.
Yeah, so it moves around.
It moves around, and then he has people standing in all corners holding it, you know, like balancing it on this thing. And I'm like, what kind of impractical, terrible idea would you want to climb up on this platform that's balancing around to sit on your chair? It's so dumb. It's so dumb looking.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I know we're bashing it, but that's what makes it bad good, is that you just like, it's so off the reservation that you kind of got to like it. All right. Thumbs up, but not for it, you know, rush out to go see it. But if you really want a bad good movie, you could probably do worse than Barbarians.
Sure. Yeah. It's a, I mean, know what to expect. It's good, bad at best.
At goofy, best. Yeah.
Lots of action scenes, a lot of cheesy 80s everything.
And it's sword not and great action either. It's just corny.
No. Yeah.
Action. Yeah. Okay. It's your turn, Dennis. What do you got for me this week?
Okay. We're gonna go with another kind of I don't even know what, cheesy something something, and watch A Knight's Tale.
Oh, you're killing me. All right, fine. I almost, before we had this podcast, that's one movie I would have sworn off from ever watching again. But
now I had a similar reaction at the time when I watched it. I was like, this is not, like, I was offended at how inaccurate it was.
Yeah, and that's what it is. That's what did it for me, is how.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's intentional. I mean, it has to be intentional.
Yeah, they're playing We Will Rock You at one scene, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. They're playing Queen. Like, it's, I think maybe, and I didn't, when I picked this early before we started recording, I didn't think of this as a direct follow-up to The Barbarians, but I think they were going for the same kind of thing. Like, it's supposed to be campy and bad. Like, it's okay. Intentional.
So I should watch it like that, like a kind of, like, it's a comedy.
I mean, you and I have both seen it. I have not seen it for, oh, I don't know, 15 or 20 years.
Oh, yeah. I watched it once when it came out.
Yeah. Like, when it was first in the video stores or whatever. And so, yeah, I want to give it another shot through that lens of, like, this is supposed to be campy and
all right. I will definitely give it a shot based on those grounds alone, because both of us have made that mistake before, where we mistaken a film for what we thought was something else.
Right.
All right. So A Knight's Tale, and I do like Heath Ledger in general.
Heath Ledger, yeah. It's from 2001, so it's over 23 years old.
Sure. Craziness. Okay, what do we got here next? So I saw the first episode of Fallout.
Okay.
I felt guilty watching it because I should have been watching Shogun. I sat down and I was eating dinner and I put on a thing and I thought, well, Shogun is when I always watch the screen, paying attention, you know, right. I want to be able to like eat my dinner and kind of lightly have something on. So maybe Fallout was that one. But I'd still have my attention. And it actually took my full attention because it's pretty good. I know you've watched it all. Can you talk about just the first episode or?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
without like giving opinions on all of the rest of it? Or maybe. But,
yeah. Right, right. I mean, let's just assume that we spent the next half hour ranting about the binge TV show model. I can't believe anybody not Netflix is still doing this.
right.
But Amazon did this for this. I was a little cautious because our buddy Fox started it first and just watched the first episode and was just raving about it. Like, it's the greatest thing he's ever seen. I think that's maybe part of what I was trying to get at earlier with Shogun, because my brother said the first episode of Shogun hooked him like the first episode of Game of Thrones. And I'm like, okay. I don't think anything will hook me the way the first episode of Game of Thrones did, the whole first season. And so, like, that's a high bar. It's like anytime somebody compares something to Lord of the Rings, I'm like, dial it back. And which is not to say that Shogun is not very good, because I enjoy it a lot. It is very well made, very, you know, excellent. But we talked about Shogun already. I think there's just so much about the vibe of Fallout that they nailed. It's, you know, people try to compare it to The Last of Us, but as
That's
I
what I was trying
understand
to
it,
ask. Yeah.
having never played The Last of Us, I know enough about that game to know that it's a narrative game. Like, it's a straight through story, like an Uncharted game.
Yeah.
And Fallout is very much not that. Like, there are stories, like there are big stories going on, but it's an open world game. So, for example, in Fallout 4, the game starts with you, the player character, being trapped in a you know, cryo sleep pod or whatever, and your son or your child being kidnapped. And so you go out into the wasteland, ostensibly to go find and rescue your son. But in the meanwhile, you find the Brotherhood of Steel, and you find these settlements where you can build, right? You can scrap all the, like, baseballs and bowling pins and used cans of cram, which is similar to but legally distinct from spam.
Yeah.
Cans, like, to make metal and wood and build walls and put down floors, and you build a whole little village and you put your different workstations so you can reload and modify your weapons, and you bring NPCs there so they can work the shops so that you can buy and sell the stuff that you find. You build a whole village in like hours and hours. It's part of why I bounced off of Fallout 4, because I got to a certain point with the mods, and things where I'd spent dozens of hours building up these towns and not doing anything with the story of the game or the various
Yeah.
stories. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just gonna go play something else. I don't remember what I bounced off of for, but and so,
I bounce off of all Bethesda games for that reason, like all of
yeah,
them, I
I
think.
think the only Fallout that I finished was New Vegas. And that I'm almost certain was a Gamefly game that I got on probably the Xbox 360. That's one of those, like, the longer I keep it, the more of my subscription cost is paying for it. And so I want to play through, like, that was a time when I was doing that with a bunch of single player console games, is just playing through them and sending them back or bouncing off them, which I did with Final Fantasy 13, I want to say. But that one I finished. 4 I bounced off of. I only played 76 for like an hour,
Yeah.
maybe a couple hours. And 3, I know I played 3 before 4. That actually might not be true.
See, I play
I
I
put
three is the
I
one that
played
I
3.
actually played, and I played it. I
Yeah.
did play it all the way through.
Yeah, I
It's,
played
yeah.
it for a couple hours. But I don't remember getting very far in it. Anyway, there are a lot of stories. Fallout is, as they say, more of a vibe than a game, like a one story kind of thing, because there's just a lot. Like, you find a town, you find some people, they have some, you know, there's just a lot of different stories, because the whole thing is about, you know, just this setting, this aesthetic, which with, you know, retro, what did we call it in the Discord? Like, retrofuturism,
Yeah.
but it's right, so it's the future. There are things we haven't seen. There's AI, there are robots, floating robots and mini fusion cores and stuff like that. But the aesthetic is all the 50s. Right,
Because it
it's like,
got that's when the
what
nuclear
if the
bombs went off, yeah.
what if the nuclear age advanced differently
Yeah.
than it did in the real world?
Yeah.
And then fast forward 200 years to after the bombs being dropped, and what does life look like with this idea of, you know, impregnable vaults that
People live in
People lived in have lived in for the intervening 2
200 years.
centuries.
Yeah. And you're right. That's something I think that is appealing to Fallout, the games, and Fallout. This what also works with this one is that the I guess in general Bethesda games. It's the worlds that are great. Skyrim, things like that. The Morrowind worlds, you know, Elder Scrolls worlds, I say. That's their open world games. It's the world that they create that's very interesting. And they populate these because they're open world. Morrowind was the first one I played. And you get to just like go where you want to go, when you want to go there. And it you just explore and stumble across the village. And it has this these mutant things in there. And what are they all about? And you kind of learn about them. And it's this pocket of the world. And as they made more and more of these different games, they started having a primary story. But most people, it's like you don't have to do the primary story. I know for Skyrim, I did not play the main story stuff at all. And before I quit, I barely did any of it. I did all the side quest stuff and did only what I had to with the main story. And I went back years and years later to play Skyrim just to do the main story. And Fallout's the same way. It's just it's a world with what you just described. It's got mutants and it's got this aesthetic and it's got the vaults and it has the Brotherhood and that's the world. And when people say they're making a Fallout film or a series, I was like, does Fallout have a story? And I know people are Fallout fans. Yeah, I played all the way through. I love that. Okay, sure, there is, but that's not this. It's not a story of Rick and Michonne and, you know, going through the undead world. It's just, this is the world. And then there is a story told within it.
Is that a Walking Dead
that's
reference?
One of the many, many stories told within this world. And yeah. This series seems to be just one of those stories, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I won't say any more than that because
it's okay. Yeah. Cause like I've seen in the first episode and I maybe a little spoilers for the first episode is you meet the people, you know, that are all the things and it sets them all up for what's to come. You know, you meet the ghoul, you see the things that I'm really appreciative that they showed the past. Like they showed the bombing happen. They started off with that. A lot of things like Walking Dead won't. They'll just start you in the future and say this happened. This showed us the thing and led us into the thing, into the vault.
Yeah, because in The Walking Dead, the past is the normal world. Right?
Right.
Like if you've never played a Fallout game, like if you're just dropped into the post, into the wasteland setting, you're like, why does everything look like the 50s?
Right.
And that's part of,
so it's part of it.
The whole thing. Yeah.
So yeah, I really appreciated that. I don't know how I feel about the comparisons right off the bat to say it's like, The Last of Us, because I don't think it's like, at least one episode is not like The Last of Us. It's definitely its own thing. It's good. Yeah. I'm really excited to watch it, but The Last of Us was a very personal, just like the game, very personal film or show.
Yeah, the story, I mean, you can tell from the first episode because you're following at least two stories, I think, right? You're following Lucy and Maximus from the first episode.
Yeah, and the ghoul a little bit.
Yeah, and Walton Goggins, I forget his character name. They usually just call him the ghoul. Because you get him in the flashbacks. But Lucy is the vault dweller. Maximus is a low ranking Brotherhood of Steel guy, and Walton Goggins plays a ghoul, right? Who is you learn, I think, also
in the first one, you know that he's like kept alive somehow. We don't know how, but
I mean he's in the trailer as a ghoul, so this is not a spoiler. Like you see him in the trailer as a ghoul, and then in the beginning of the first episode you see the past and he's just a normal person,
right? He's been around for 200 some years.
You know that he somehow is still alive 200 years later as a ghoul.
Right off the bat
the story of the Fallout series is bigger than The Last of Us, because The Last of Us really just follows Joel and Ellie with a few side quests.
Right. It's just them, you know, these two very deep characters living in your experiencing the world through them. In this one, it feels like the Fallout games we were just describing, a big, broad world with some characters who are going to go on an adventure. Right. Heck, yeah. The main character girl, when she walks out of the vault, you feel like, here I go, going on to an adventure, you know.
It's very much, and they do, I'm sure that people who have played the games more than us, and I'm sure these are on YouTube, I know that I've seen them on my recommendation YouTube page thing, YouTube homepage, whatever you call that, where people spot all of the little Easter eggs. I mean, I spotted a lot of them, where they're like, oh, there's that thing, there's this, they're eating a lot of Spam, right, because it's cram, and yeah, they've got Nuka-Cola machines everywhere, and
yeah,
it's just full of those little references. And actually, the I don't know if you get this until episode 2, but in episode 2 they say something about the water chip, the like processing the chip that controls their water, okay, filtration system.
Okay.
And that is from, I didn't realize this until I watched a different YouTube video today where a guy was trying out the original pre-Bethesda Fallout, because the first two Fallout games were more like Baldur's Gate. Not Baldur's Gate 3, but like the old Baldur's Gate.
Okay.
Where 3D it's
isometric type thing.
Yeah, down. Apparently it's something different from isometric. There's a different term for it, the way that like objects are rendered to look 3D, even though it's still two-dimensional top-down game.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's that idea. Like it's turn-based combat. It was originally based off of GURPS, the generic universal role places, whatever that's called.
Yeah.
The like the D&D competitor, I assume.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were back in the day. Yeah.
And apparently, the only reason Fallout has its own stat system, the special systems like strength, perception, endurance, charisma, intelligence, agility, and luck. Wow. I'm surprised I came up with all of those.
Right.
Is because they told the developer, you know, the designers of GURPS, which is Steve Jackson, I want to say.
Really? Okay. Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know that, but this video with the Fallout 1, like he showed the Wikipedia page and I was like, oh, Steve Jackson, that's wild. Mm-hmm. And they didn't like how like grim and violent the video game was supposed to be. This is like 1996, 97. And so didn't want them to use GURPS stuff. And so they made their own stat system, and it's why they have luck, and you know, they have the stats that they have had all the way through. Anyway, one of the first missions you have to do, like the reason you venture out of the vault in Fallout 1 is because the water chip is broken and they don't have the parts to fix it, and you have to go find a neighboring vault to look for a replacement. And so it's like that, not just as a need, like it's a minor thing in the show, but people who know be like, oh, the water chip, that's a thing from the thing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, the people, I know that the video games have gotten a boost in sales since the show came out, and people are like, oh, definitely, I maybe go buy it. And they're really super cheap right now to buy them. But I know our buddy Trotsky's one of them, and I kind of had a side eye to it, because if you're looking for an experience like the show, okay, and I've only seen one episode, I don't think they're going to get that when they load up a Fallout game. Like it's not going to have a narrative. There's not going to be story. It's very much a experience and explore this world. So if people watched Fallout, and you might know this because you've seen them all, and it's all about the world that's interesting and cool, and not necessarily the characters, then Fallout will be it'll be fine. But that's not what I'm seeing. I really loved the first episode. The characters in this world seemed interesting and cool, and I want to learn.
Yeah.
So if that's where they go and try to find out, ooh, I want to see if I can play the ghoul or follow this other person on their event. No, none of that is, it's not, the games aren't anything like that or about that at all. So
yeah, I bought New Vegas, even though I've played it before, but I already own 2 and 4 on Steam. I think I have 76 on PlayStation 4, but I don't have my PlayStation in the camper with me. And I, of all of them, 76 is probably the one I would least play because it's a true first-person shooter with no VATS. And that's one of the things that I like about the Fallout games is that even though it's a first-person shooter, there's no reflex. Like, shoot, I mean, you can play it like that. You can play it without VATS. But, you know, I'm too slow for first-person. I mean, I was 15 years ago, and it's only gotten worse. and I played it for like an hour. I don't know if I'll go back to it. It's 2012, so the graphics and everything in it are pretty old. And I know it's a game that is just really time consuming. I've also been trying to like open the games a little less frequently because I went straight from Factorio into Captain of Industry. I think I talked about that last week and just like waste a whole evening, not waste, but like spend a whole evening playing some game. And I'm like, I need to dial this back. Consequently, I've been playing Soulstone Survivors again. You've been playing that one.
I did.
Again, what I like about it, and I'm sure I said this like a year and a half ago or whenever we played that before, I like that it's matches, right? You get in and it's like 20 to 30 minutes and it's over. It is much more stressful than a factory sim game. It's very twitchy. Not very twitchy, but it can be. I had a couple builds where I just stacked move speed, and I'm like, this is giving me a headache.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, I almost always try to stack move because I can't see everything that's happening, so I have to run fast.
Better run out of things. I mean, you have to move all because there's stuff on the ground you have to dodge all the time.
All the time.
And it just gets worse the further the match goes.
Yeah. I liked the classes and the character. They all seem very different, and the abilities are all very widely different from each other. And also, something I like about Soulstone Survivors is that, and like all these kind of games, Vampire Survivors, whatever, is I don't have to worry about, am I using my abilities at the right time? Do I save my ultimate for this bit thing? It just, they just fire.
Because it all auto casts, yeah.
Yeah, which is like, that's great. I just buy the thing and it's going to use it all the time. So it was very freeing for me, I'll put it that way. Okay, what do we got here? We said some things before we go, cause we're at time here now. I mentioned last week that I was going to try and, fix my Nintendo Entertainment System. And by fix, I mean, I was going to try and get the yellowing out of it, recondition it or something. And I mentioned that I found some things online and I was going to report back how it was. So I got this, a lot of people were restoring. This is called restoring. A lot of people had suggested this stuff called Salon 25. It's just a hair conditioner type thing. Go to Amazon, it's like $20. And you clean your, take all of the components out of the nest, just screws. So you use the plastic shell left. And you clean it really well. And then you just put this Salon stuff all over it using a toothbrush, you know, just kind of get it evenly. Wrap it in just Saran wrap, plastic wrap, and put it in the sun for several hours. And that's what...
Oh, so you are using UV light.
Yes, you absolutely are using UV light. that's what is supposed to fix it magically. And lo and behold, it did, Dennis. It absolutely fixed it. I was so much so that I was so disbelieving of it, I didn't take before and after pictures because it was so incredibly yellowed. And then when it came out and it's really, really nice, I was like, wow, this can't be what happened. And it's got a little bit of yellowing where I didn't turn it, like not all sides got into the sun evenly. So I'm going to go ahead and do another coat, I guess, on it, put it out one more time. But man, it went from like cigarette stain yellow to almost original color. I was so impressed at how easy and simple it was. So if you're listening and you want to restore your old yellowed systems, Salon 25. Just go to Amazon and just put in Salon 25. It comes up one of the first things. It's very inexpensive, and it will. And I had one thing, and I, one will do any system that I have, like a quarter, maybe even a tenth of it is enough to coat the whole thing. And I've got a Super Nintendo that is just as bad and yellowed, and I'm going to go ahead and take before and after pictures of that one and show that one off, because I want to do it. Problem with that one is that Super Nintendo, they decided to use very specialized screws that you have to have a special tool to do. Right. That tool only cost $8 on Amazon, but still I had to order it and get it.
And it
did make me very nervous unscrewing the Nintendo, because it is an old system and I don't want to mess with any of the innards, you know?
Sure.
But it's, you know, I know enough about hardware now, and that it wasn't a big problem. Sometimes right. these systems are like soldered in, so if you screw something up, you know, it breaks a bit. This did not. And I was sad to see that inside of it, some of the tin or the metal or aluminum shielding stuff had been rusted, and there's not much I can do about that. It's fine. Now, the hardware is bad, but just internal systems where it was kept in a damp room or some kind of thing. I still have the guts sitting out on my table, and it's weird to me to see the guts, knowing now what I know about how motherboards and or chipsets and everything work. I can look at this and know kind of what this I'm looking at,
right?
And it was just science fiction technology for me back then, and now I can look at it and see, oh, they've got a really, here's their RAM chip and here's their, you know, whatever they're using.
I'm sure that I talked about this at the time, but I listened to the audiobook of the book Console Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think they call it creative nonfiction, because it's a documentary. I don't know if documentary is the word for a book. I don't know what else it would be. But has a lot of, like, you're in the characters' heads, and I shouldn't say characters because they're real people, like you're in the people's heads and they're like in meetings and talking to each other, and I'm like, what is this, the guy just making this stuff up? Because it's not like the author is not any of those people. But one of the things that Nintendo did in the 80s is because and I didn't realize this is one of the things I learned from reading this book, like Atari and maybe to a lesser extent Activision were basically open. Like anybody could develop games for the Atari, for the 2600 and the other consoles. And so the market just got flooded with low quality games and like adult games and whatever. I don't know what kind of adult games you could have on a 2600, but they made them. And it led to this like crash of video games. Because, you know, the 80s kind of, I don't know, moral culture started to pick up, and the video games got a really bad reputation. And so Nintendo, when they sort of weathered that storm because they had a market in Japan, like rose to prominence in the 80s by doing some really, like draconian business practices, right? Like you couldn't sell a game for the NES unless you had the cartridge, right? Unless you could unless you could print it or load it onto cartridges. And Nintendo would only sell a certain amount of cartridges to certain companies a year. Like they controlled that market. Nobody else could make the cartridges. You had to get them from Nintendo, and they'd have like a chip in them that was proprietary, right? Nobody else could make it, so it's encrypted or whatever, to intentionally make sure that, again, the market was not flooded with games of low quality, to make sure that what was being made was good, and there was no, and they had no competition until they went into 16-bit and Sega dropped the Genesis, right? And then they had all this stuff with the different markets, right? Like Sega deliberately targeted an older market than Nintendo. It's part of how Nintendo still has a reputation for being the family console or the kids console. I mean, the Japanese version of the NES was called family computer, like Famicom.
Famicom, yeah.
Anyway, why did I bring that up? Oh, you were talking about the chips and opening it up and the special screws on the
right.
on the SNES. Made me think of that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's cool. I like what it did. Very, very happy. I was really bummed about how yellow those were. I'll definitely get to you with, you know, before and after pictures. Hopefully this week, if it's nicer out, I've got some conferences to go to, so I don't know if I'll be able to do much, but I'm excited to revitalize my things. And it works, I guess it works on any yellowed plastic from the old plastic stuff.
You can just sure, it sure.
It'll pull it out. Kind of crazy.
Cool.
Cool, man.
All right. Well, you've been listening to The Front Porch. It's episode 346. Thanks always to our friends at LRM Online. You can check them out for reviews on things. If you would like to reach out to us and tell us everything we're wrong about the Fallout franchise, game franchise, you can do that via email. Our address is frontporchpod@gmail.com. If you go to our website, frontporchpodcast.com, you'll find contact forms to reach out to us. And I'll put links to the games and movies and also a YouTube video from a channel I like where a guy restores an NES that's all yellowed.
Oh, yeah.
If you enjoy the show, please consider subscribing on the podcatcher of your choice. And while you're there, if you would leave us a 5-star review, please appreciate that. It helps out a lot in the rankings. As always, thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Dennis.
And I'm Michael.
For The Front Porch.
Night, everybody.
See you next time.